Hey, I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Yes.
I'm really happy to be here today. I want to thank Chris for asking me. I was talking with Jesse before the meeting about, he said, you know, have you done this before? And, you know, and my answer is, yeah, if somebody asks, I say yes. That's what I was taught early on in recovery, and that's what I've tried to do. 40 minutes is a long time, so I'm going to try to I have zero plan at all about what I'm going to say other than to talk about, I guess, why I'm standing here today. I guess the other thing that I'll say, because I was talking to Jesse about this before also, I've been sober, so my sobriety day is July 24th, 1988. I was 20 years old when I got sober. And I've been doing this a long time, and I still get nervous when I come up here. Part of it is because my mind. And for those of you that are new, there's a lot of good news and some bad news that I'll be sharing. Some of the bad news is I'm still fucking crazy, but I'm sober. I haven't had a drink. I haven't had a drug in a very, very long time. I'm able to get through the day. Appearing to most people on the outside as if I'm a normal member of the human race. What's going on inside here, in a lot of ways, is the same kind of stuff that was going on before I ever found drugs and alcohol, and during and after. My actions are very, very different today. So I still really want every single one of you who I've never met before to think that I'm super fucking cool. And that, like, I'm amazing, and that everything I say is going to be just like this powerful wisdom, and you're going to all walk out of the room here more sober than you've ever been. And a huge amount of that is just my ego. But some part of it, honestly and genuinely, is that I've been doing this long enough that this spirit of service, of wanting to be of use, there's a bit of an intensity to wanting to say things that actually can help people. I've heard more stuff from people that I've never met before in rooms just like this that have changed the course of my life. And the trick is that happens almost every time I go to an AA meeting. I'm an addict. I really love quick, permanent fixes. I love the idea of being able to do something and then just be done with it. That has not been my experience. That was not my experience using. That certainly hasn't been my experience in recovery. And I need to hear life-altering things that are a new way of looking at stuff. And I need to hear that like a few times a day, basically. Otherwise, I get back into the same kind of thinking, and eventually the same kind of actions that got me here. So I'll back up briefly. So I'm turning 50 this year. I got sober when I was 20. So my story of what it was like is actually pretty short and boring and pedestrian. But super briefly, I felt like an alien from the minute that I was conscious. Everyone else was cool, calm, and collected, and could talk to girls and could do all those things that were just completely mystifying to me. I discovered drugs and immediately, actually. So I got drunk, I got laid, and I got high in the same week, and my whole life changed. Everything my parents had ever told me was completely wrong, and then I just wanted to feel that way forever, and was blacking out, you know, behind the wheel of a car from the day I got my driver's license. I was really bad at keeping it together. I know a lot of people who were able to sort of get married, have a career, and be, you know, shooting up on the side. Like, that was not my experience. I was just a catastrophe kind of from the start. Got arrested, got sent to a facility kind of like this one. Did not want to be there at all. Had no intentions of doing anything other than just saying the things that I thought that I would need to say to fool enough people that they would let me out. Got high the day I got out. And that was sort of the next phase of things really changing for me, because my using was interrupted. I probably would have gone on for a lot longer had I not reached this point where I got arrested and everyone around me knew what was going on. And it's not like I was really hiding it, but they sort of figured out the depths of it. And so then this next phase was me not wanting to be sober, but because I was seeing a probation officer and getting drug tested, I had to not use. And I had never tried to not use. I know lots of people who spend years and years and years trying to quit and can't. This was my first experience, and it was completely untenable from day one. I could not, even knowing what the consequences were, I could not control my behavior. And it was years later in recovery where, you know, I finally started to understand some of what was going on. But the sort of fundamental fact there that I learned about was this idea that we read about in the first step, this concept of the phenomenon of craving. And what that means to me, you know, we talk about the fact that we have an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. And that allergy of the body, that was something that really upset me and confused me when I first heard people talking about it, because it's, you know, it's not really an allergy. What does that mean? You know, the allergy is when I take this shit, I feel great. You know, that's not what allergies are like. But what the phenomenon of craving, my understanding of it and how it works with me is that if I get anything mind-altering in my system, then all bets are off. I have no control over what happens next. There were certainly times when I was trying to control it where I could just do a little bit. But the times when I set out to do a little bit and then, you know, woke up in another state, you know, somewhere where I didn't know where I was and how I got there, there was no difference between those. It wasn't like I had control certain times and didn't have control other times. It was just the outcomes were different. But I had no control. And the other thing about this allergy for me, and I've heard a lot of other people in meetings, so I think it's consistent with a lot of us, is that as soon as there's anything mind-altering in my system, I want more. I am not satisfied ever with anything. It's as simple as that. It's the, you know, one is too many and 1,000 is never enough. And that the nice thing is that has persisted into recovery. And I say that's a nice thing because it's a constant reminder. With many, many years of recovery, can get hooked on anything that changes the way that I feel. And when I look back at that, you know, how I felt before I was an alien, I found this thing that just fixed all my problems. My fundamental spiritual malady is that I believe that there's something outside that can fix what's going on inside. And as long as I am looking for something outside to fix me, as long as I think there's a problem that needs fixing, then I'm likely to end up doing things that take me away from what I have found in these rooms that I can do, which is actually be of use to other people. And so this first step to me, a huge part of it was just being able to unpack all of these experiences and all of these examples where I had no control once I took the first drug, drink, whatever. And then the obsession part is that even knowing what all of the consequences were, I couldn't stop myself from doing that first thing again. And I was reading, I don't want to get academic here, but I was reading this thing about, there's this famous psychologist named B.F. Skinner who had this theory where he basically sort of said that all of human behavior is in response to either positive or negative stimulus, and that when something positive happens, it's reinforcing and we want to do that again, and when something negative happens, it's a negative reinforcement, we don't want to do it. And what I think is different about me and maybe some of you is that I don't think that negative reinforcement thing works with me. My experience is that, like, I have this ridiculously high capacity for suffering. I can do things that have terrible negative consequences and convince myself that that's not something that should alter my future behavior, that next time I'm going to get it right. It's this illusion, it talks about in the book, it's this illusion of control, that somehow, someday, I can control whatever this thing is. So a big part of the first step for me, and I'm going to talk about the steps because that's just the easiest framework for me to talk about recovery. The first step for me just boiled down to understanding this notion of this allergy of the body, this obsession of the mind, and that what it all boils down to for me is this illusion of control. And that, as the book says, had to be smashed. I had to be beaten into a state of reasonableness where enough of those negative consequences happened over and over and over and over and over again that I finally woke up one morning not wanting to change my life, not wanting to be a sober guy and, you know, at 50 be standing here in a room like this with all of you talking to you. I just wanted to stop feeling like shit. That was it. I woke up one morning and just didn't want to feel like shit that day. And because I had been to this treatment program and because I had to go to meetings and get that card signed, and because everyone else I knew was getting high, for that one day, the only reasonable idea I had was to go to a meeting. And so I started going to meetings, this time just really to kind of hide away from that other part of my life. And what happened was it eventually started to kind of wear into me. There was this guy who was sort of ran this first meeting that I'd gone to, and he took another young guy. So I'm 20 now. And there was another guy who was like 22 who'd been sober a couple of years, and he basically took this guy and said, just babysit him. And so for the next 8 weeks, because it was the summer before my senior year of college, I somehow had managed with all of this legal shit to not get kicked out of school, and I was going back to finish up college. And this guy basically just every single day took me to a meeting, took me out to lunch, took me to coffee, maybe took me to another meeting. I had no idea what was going on. I thought he was like my new buddy and we were just hanging out, but he was babysitting me. He was just keeping me out of trouble. The amazing thing about this is that all these years later, I'd never stopped sort of thinking about that that experience and that guy. This is in the years before cell phones and Facebook and all that stuff. So I lost touch with this guy, and I saw him in a meeting about 2 or 3 years ago. And I went up afterwards. I'm like, "Hey, dude, it's me. It's Chris. You know, thank you so much." He had no idea who I was, and that was a really powerful experience for me to see. I mean, the part of what we do here and part of what keeps me sober and keeps me coming back is that I am able to get through each day and getting out of my own head and changing those thought patterns by just thinking about someone else a couple minutes at a time. And people in and around recovery do extraordinary things for people who they don't know, who they might not remember because there's maybe thousands of people over the years that they've done that for. And it's because that's the only thing that keeps me sober. So to jump around a little bit, the second and third step was a huge roadblock for me, as it is for a lot of people. I came into these rooms. The idea of God, the first AA meeting I went to when I saw how many times the word God was on the wall, like it was clear to me that this was just a bad dream, that I was in the wrong place. There's no way. Whatever problems I had, I guarantee you that was not the solution to it. And so I was one of those people that they talk about in the appendix on the spiritual experience in the big book of having a spiritual experience of the educational variety. So I did not like Bill Wilson. If you guys have read Bill's story, Bill was in Towns Hospital, saw this white light, the wind blew through, and suddenly he sort of was struck sober. I was definitely not struck sober, and I definitely did not want to talk about God. I didn't want to hear people talk about God. I was still maybe sober a couple of years, and if someone in a meeting was talking about God, I would get all nervous that the newcomer would want to get up and leave. What 2 and 3 really boil down to for me today, though, and I've now, years later, I can talk about God all day long. I'm not going to do that here. It's not the same God that people hear about in church, but I have a real experience of what my life is like when I turn my will and my life over to something that is greater than me, whatever the hell that is, and when I don't. And there's a huge difference between those two. But the third step, and I did have a tough time with this idea of turning my will and my life over to the care of God as we understood him, as the step says. I didn't really understand this notion of my will, and I certainly didn't understand what God's will was. And that's the thing that I can say today with certainty is I don't know what God is. I know that, you know, if you ask 1,000 people in AA, you're going to get it probably, you know, at least 900 slightly different answers there. But I do feel like at this point I have a pretty good actual understanding of what God's will is. And what God's will is, the sort of test for me usually is if there's something that I really want, it's probably my will. And if there's something that is happening right now, that's probably God's will. And that's like the simplest distinction for me is it's just like reality and truth is what God's will is. And stuff that I want to happen is my will. And the third step for me is just trying to align my will with God's will. And the trick, there's a bunch of different ways that I've thought about it over time, but I have a good friend in the room who I heard basically say that his sort of practice of the third step, he boils down to this simple phrase of, I don't know. And that's something that I've adopted and has really helped me tremendously. So I can approach any situation that's going on in my life and, like a lot of people, be full of fear and anxiety. And it usually boils down to, you know, I've heard a couple of people describe it. There's sort of three basic fears that we all have. One is there's something I want that I'm afraid I'm not going to get. There's something that I have I'm afraid I'm going to lose. Or, and this is kind of a sneaky one, but there's something I've done that I think if you find out, you're going to despise me for. But almost all of those, if you think about it, those are all things that are not happening right now. Those are all things that could happen. Some of them might be related to things that have happened in the past, but they have nothing to do with reality right now. My sponsor likes to say I've experienced many, many tragedies, some of which actually happened. And that is my experience. There's way more. I have this unbelievably rich and active imagination about all of the terrible things that can happen. That's part of what I was trying to change with drugs and alcohol, and what I've tried to change with sex and food and running and anything else that I can do to get out of it. But it's that my brain goes really, really fast, and there's this idea that I heard someone describe of mental proliferation. And what that basically means is, like, I can think about, I have two daughters who are 19 and 21 now. My 19-year-old was having a rough year at school. She's the daughter of two drug addicts and alcoholics, so she's grown up in a completely sober home, but she's got crazy parents, realistically speaking. So she's inherited some of our emotional makeup. She has a tough time at school, and to her credit, she raised her hand and said, I'm having a tough time. I need to take some time off, come home, get a job, work, get into therapy, get some help. And we're like, great, come on home. So in my mind, I'm the supportive dad. That's great. But then what I'm thinking is, okay, she's never going to go back to school. She's going to end up living with us forever, or she's going to end up, you know, getting pregnant and never going to school. And it's the mental proliferation is the 15 steps ahead from what's happening right now. So the practice of the third step of turning over my will and my life, aligning myself to what is reality. So part of the question is, what is happening right now? Okay, what is happening right now is my daughter just called and said, I'm having a tough time. I want to come home. Great. How can I support you? How can I be of service? That's what I've learned here. That's not my natural tendency. That's not how I think. That's not how I solve problems. But when I stay around other people who are sober, when I do the things that I'm supposed to do here, it eventually changes the way that, again, not necessarily the way that I think, but it puts this short pause between the thought and the action, and I can actually do and say things that are different than the things that I would do otherwise. I'll talk. Let me see how we're doing halfway through. We will be amazed before we're halfway through. Are you all amazed? So I'll talk about the inventory specifically, so 4 and 5, in the context of the 6th and 7th step, which is all about our character defects. And I'm talking about the steps because I'll just back up again. This is, I think, where it all happens. So there's meetings, and there's the fellowship, and there's working with a sponsor, and then there's the steps. And I have, in my years in recovery, I've tried to basically do it by just sort of practicing the steps and not being around other alcoholics. And I've spent many years just going to meetings and talking good talk, but not actually doing anything. The only thing that keeps me sane and sober is all of that. And I have my practice today is that I believe at this stage in my life, in my recovery, I have to be working all 12 steps. And I'm not in maintenance mode. I've tried that. I'm not just going to meetings, calling my sponsor, doing a 10th step, and then I'm done. Like, I'm actively working all of them. So this stuff is all sort of fresh for me because this is how it works for me. So with the inventory, one of the outputs of that, so there's a bunch of stuff that comes out of that. One is understanding resentments, which is a huge component of being able to stay sober, is just understanding why I hate everybody so much. And that's good. And that's why, pen to paper. I heard a guy at a meeting actually on Friday say this, Thursday, I really like this. He said, my brain moves so fast and is just constantly thinking one terrible thought after another. The reason that writing is good is that it slows my brain down to the speed of my hand. And I think I hadn't heard that before, but I think that's a really sort of useful way to think about it. And it's the same as me talking to another alcoholic. When I sit and talk with my sponsor, I can only have one train of thought at a time. And it's usually easier to sort of see patterns and see what's going on. So the fourth and fifth step for me is really all about just follow the directions in the book. There's the resentments, the fears, the harms, and the sex. You just do those four lists. It's pretty straightforward. And then the trick is the fifth step, sitting with someone else and going through that, because I can't figure the shit out on my own. I'm really bad at, I think I'm really good. I'm sort of a super analytical guy, and I can look at patterns and figure stuff out. I'm just wrong most of the time when it comes to diagnosing myself. I'm really good at diagnosing all of you. I'm sure I could sit down and tell each one of you what your character defects are. But in terms of myself, I usually miss the big picture. So one big thing that comes out of that, though, those patterns, is what are my character defects? What are the things? And when I first got sober, there were the big, gross ones, like I lied about everything 100% of the time. That's an easy one to spot. Like, if I'm talking, if my lips are moving, it's not true, whatever is coming out. And so that was one that I, had to work on for 28 years. But I'm a lot better at it. Like, most of what I'm saying right now is true. I don't steal anymore. Like, I don't break the law. I usually drive the speed limit. Like, there's a lot of stuff that I used to do. That those ones are gone. But then, like, the character defects that are around now, some of them are things that are persistent and have been there forever. Some of them are new. If you stay sober long enough, we grow and change as people, and I have most of my fourth and fifth and eighth and ninth step work that I've done in recovery has been shit that's happened since I got sober. If you stay sober long enough, you will accumulate more shit. And it's important, and it's just, and I have been nearly as crazy sober as I was drunk, and I've seen it with a lot of other people, and that's why I kind of have to keep working this stuff. So the one important part for me right now about 6 and 7, about these character defects, is that the two steps are distinct, and I think all of these things, there's a really good reason why 4 and 5 are separate, why 6 and 7, 8 and 9. And so the sixth step, to me, is really about sort of understanding and getting sick of those character defects. So we're entirely ready to have all these defects of character, have God remove all these defects of character. Becoming ready is usually a process of becoming just completely and totally beaten down with my own bad actions. The trick that I've figured out for me in the last few years, though, is that I can go through that process, and then in 7, it says, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. The humbly part for me, how I've tried to practice that, is by not asking specifically for this thing that's bugging me right now to be lifted. Because the 7-step prayer, which is a really important one to me, says pretty clearly that, so what it says is that, I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. So it doesn't say, I pray that you now remove from me this particular annoying thing which is keeping me from being successful at work, or is having me fight with my wife, or is having me be an asshole. The humbly part is what I want, as sincerely as I can possibly muster, is help removing from me anything that prevents me being of maximum use. And that's actually become sort of my simple and favorite definition of a defect of character. So a defect of character is not something that annoys me. A defect of character is something that prevents me from being useful. And I believe that really the only purpose that I have in life is to be useful to others. And it's the gift that I've gotten from, ironically, from being a fucked up drug addict, is that I have this unique ability to be useful to people that I couldn't have been otherwise. So 6 and 7 are really important. So that's part of the bad news. That never ends. It never ends. It only gets worse, because the longer you're sober, the more aware I have become. And it's not like I'm always more aware today than I was yesterday, because I can certainly go through periods of being totally self-obsessed and thinking about, you know, nothing other than me. I have a good friend who likes to say that the whole purpose of AA is to get us to think about ourselves slightly less than 100% of the time. And so that is a reasonable goal, and it's progress, not perfection, as we hear. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit time-wise. 8 and 9 are huge, and I will say also lifelong and ongoing things. I got through. I was my drinking and using career was short, unlike some people. I was able to get through all of those amends of the wreckage that I did while I was using within a few years, practically speaking, all the ones that could be done. All of the 8th and 9th step work that I've done since then, which is a lot, is all shit that I've created since I've been sober. And it's helpful and humbling to realize that we are not saints, right? We are going to make mistakes, some of us a lot of them. But that the same thing that those of you, I love seeing all these families here. My guess is before being here, the situation of some of those families was a lot shittier than it is now, and even now it's probably a little more challenging than it's going to be in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. Miraculous stuff happens because people get sober and start doing these things. The same is true for mistakes that I made yesterday. So it's not just that I had the excuse that I was drunk when this happened, and then we'll be able to work through this. The magic of the 8th and 9th step to me is actually a huge part. I will just say this. A huge part of what I've found in the 8th and 9th step myself is the necessity of forgiveness of others. A huge part of, because I've made a lot of amends to people, especially in the last 5 or 10 years, where I'm sure they were wrong. I'm still pretty sure that they were wrong. But I know that I had a part, and that's the thing that the work in the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th steps, and in working with a sponsor and talking to other people about this honestly, that I can see that I played a part. Even if somebody did something to me, my overreaction, something I did 3 years ago that set up the situation that caused this to happen, and that for me to actually go and make an amends to someone who I think wronged me, that's one of the most powerful things that I've ever experienced. And that's happened to me just twice now in the last 3 months, where I ended up making amends to people that I worked with 15 years ago who I didn't even think that they were amends that needed to be made, because these guys were such fucking selfish assholes. They were completely, totally wrong about everything. And then sort of by mistake, the opportunity came up, and I saw an opening, and I just made an amends for my behavior. And it was amazing how this thing that I've been holding on to for 15 years just melted away. And that is always available to me. So 10, 11, and 12, people call those the maintenance steps. To me, it's just 10, 11, and 12. I'm doing all the other stuff. Although a 10th step, one way to think about the 10th step is that it's sort of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 all together. The way I practice 10 today, and I'll also just preface this all with, this is what I'm doing today. I have spent many years in recovery not doing stuff and being crazier. The stuff that I'm doing now is helping me to act less crazy. I just do a really simple nightly inventory of the form of the fourth step. It's just really short, so I'm not going through, you know, a spreadsheet with a whole bunch of columns, but I'm just every single day writing down who am I resentful at today, you know, what is my part in that, what are my fears, what harms did I cause today. The sex stuff, that's the one thing that I will say in 28 years of recovery has definitely been, I've been, this summer I'll be married 25 years to the same person. I have been with one person for 25 years. That's almost more miraculous than the fact that I haven't had a drink or a drug. There's certain types of wreckage that I just haven't been creating, and that's definitely a miracle. But the one piece of that 10th step is that actually, to me, it doesn't matter specifically what I'm doing on any night. It's that I'm doing some daily reflection of what's gone on and where my head is at, and then I'm sharing that with someone else because I need that. And I did not ever wake up in the morning when I was using and say, you know, I got pretty high yesterday. I don't need to get high today. But it's very easy to say, I went to a meeting yesterday. I don't need to go to one today. Or I prayed. I did this yesterday. I'm good today. And the truth is, this disease is not a part-time thing. It doesn't hit only Tuesday afternoon. I mean, it is the fundamental sort of fact of my life, and I need a program. Someone actually, I heard this recently, I really like it too. You know, they talk about the disease is progressive, it only gets worse. Recovery is progressive too, but like I actually need to be more committed at 50 than I was at 40 or 30 or 20. Part of it is that I'm fucking 50. My life is more complicated. I've got teenage kids who are having their own sets of problems. I've been, you know, incredibly lucky to end up with a job that has a bunch of responsibility that causes some anxiety that's sort of reasonable. I've been married to the same person for 25 years, which is a miracle, but I mean, if anyone's even dated someone for 25 weeks, you know, marriage is complicated. I need more recovery today than I needed 10 years ago. And the great thing is it's here and it's available. And I also happen to be incredibly lucky in that I fucking love AA. That's definitely not always been true, but I really, really do love it here. And a huge part of it is just that you can't be unaffected seeing miracles on a daily basis. And I've seen amazing, amazing stuff happen in my time here. 11 and 12, I'll talk super briefly about 11, really to say that a big part of the 11th step, and again, regardless of anyone's perspective on God, so when I first was sort of going through that struggle in early recovery, I had a friend actually who I used to use with, who got sober about 6 months after me. He went off to treatment. He came back to visit me, and we went to a meeting, we hung out, and then I came in at night, and he was praying. I was like, Pete, what are you doing? He's like, I'm praying. It's like, really? You do that? He's like, yeah, we're supposed to do this. And so I just started this whole, taking literally this concept of acting as if. So it seemed completely stupid and irrelevant. It would be like if you told me I had cancer, but what I needed to do was like climb a mountain and then my cancer was going to go away. You're telling me that if I pray to something that I don't believe in, that somehow that's going to change things. And it did. And it was this huge leap to just listen to what people who had walked this path before me said that I should do. And instead of arguing that I'm different and I'm unique or I don't need this piece, that I'm just going to do what they say. Another friend basically likes to say that, you know, you come in here and they tell us to do all these goofy things. And if you do the goofy things, shit happens. And so prayer and meditation, again, it's now become a big part of my life. Meditation in particular is something that I completely ignored until I was like 20 years sober. A big part of it was, you know, I just said like my head is too busy, I can't meditate. I have come to believe that that's kind of like saying I'm too sick, I can't go to the doctor. The reason that I need to meditate is because my head won't shut down. And meditation, at least the way that I've learned it and been practicing it, is not about being completely blissed out and serene. It's about just sitting with whatever is going on. And if that means my leg hurts, if my mind won't shut up, if I can't stop thinking about something that somebody said to me yesterday, that's still meditation. And that practice, just like when I first started praying, just sitting and doing that for 1 minute at a time, for 2 minutes at a time, it has been as big a transformation in my recovery as almost anything else that I've ever done. So for anyone who hasn't tried meditating, especially because you think that you're bad at it, that's exactly the reason to give it a shot. And at least what I heard is there's no such thing as bad meditation. So that's been incredibly helpful to me. So 12, I'll finish up. The 12th step is sort of where this all happens, because of the part of, again, I was a long time sober before I caught that meditation part in the 11th step that, you know, had been there all along. I kind of had also took a while to really get that. So there's the having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics, and that was sort of my understanding of the 12-step was. It was like, okay, it was 12-step work. But then there's and practice these principles in all of our affairs. So that's the part that's actually the trick. These principles, when Bill talks about these principles, he's talking about the steps. So what he's saying is the 12-step is we get this amazing gift from having done this work, where suddenly we can look at the world slightly differently. And then the two things that we have to do with this are, one, we have to help other people, and two, we have to keep doing this shit all day long, every day. And maybe it's good that I didn't figure that out right away, because I might have not signed up for this. But that is, my head is going 24 hours a day. It's not like it ever gives me a break. So I need to actually do this stuff. And part of that in early recovery was the jump from I could be honest with another alcoholic. Okay, I could be honest in a room full of alcoholics. But as soon as I left, then it was very different. And a big part of that is practicing the stuff at work, which is really fucking hard, with my family, which is really fucking hard. But that's where the transformation comes in, because the whole goal is to be able to live a happy, joyous, and free life. And that doesn't come from just doing something part of the time. And so the way that I think about kind of how this stuff all fits together, a word that has recently, you know, I've heard it in meetings a bunch of times, heard people talk about it, but this has really meant a lot to me in the last few years is the word grace. And when I think about what grace is, I heard somebody describe in a meeting difference between mercy, justice, and grace. So justice is getting what you deserve. Mercy is not getting what you deserve. And grace is getting something you don't deserve. And that's what this all feels like to me. It certainly isn't justice, because the shit that I did, the shit that I've done, I did nothing to deserve to be here. If there was justice, I'd be dead or in jail. And the grace is that I've been given this gift, and I now know how much of a gift it is, because I've seen a bunch of my first sponsor died drunk and alone in a hotel. The guy who 12-stepped me and got me sober now has 4 years, 24 years later. And I've seen a bunch of people die. I've seen a bunch of people who sincerely wanted it and tried and did all this stuff and couldn't get it. And somehow somehow I got it. And I don't know why. What I do know is that I have a responsibility as a result to take that thing and do everything that I can with it. Because it's not something that I deserve, it's not something that I earned, and the only way that I get to keep it is by being of use, by being of service, by when someone asks me to come and talk at a meeting, coming to talk at a meeting, when someone says, my mom just died, will you come to the funeral with me, doing that, whatever it is. That's how it's worked for me, and that's my 40 minutes. So I'm just going to say thank you all for sitting and listening through all this, and I'm glad to be here.